Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan. Today we're treading the boards in both New York and here in London for this month's theatre review. And joining me in the studio is critic for the International New York Times, Matt Wolfe. Matt, welcome to the program. I think we should probably start in New York, shouldn't we?
Thank you, Ben. Sure, sure.
You were there just recently, and it sounds like the stars have been out in force on the Big Apple's theatre scene this month. Who did you see on the stage during your recent trip?
Well, New York loves nothing more than a big star, and luckily this season has a lot of them, off-Broadway and on-Broadway. So off-Broadway, in a theater not hugely bigger than the room we're sitting in, you can see a very fine modern dress production of Othello, starring none other than Daniel Craig as Iago and David Oyelowo as Othello. Two mighty talents in a small room, and that's very exciting just before anything even happens.
So there'd be a lot of people attracted to that production simply to see these two people not only performing, but performing in such an intimate atmosphere. It's always a treat.
Oh, yeah. I mean, up close and personal. In bleacher-style seating, the production is done in a kind of barracks-like environment, so you don't even feel as if you're in a theater. You're sort of eavesdropping on events that, of course, get cataclysmic very quickly, and you're right on top of it. You're, of course, powerless to stop it, and the production goes on its inexorable course. Really thrillingly, it's a very fine production.
Now, we often raise this topic when we talk about screen actors jumping up on the stage, that sometimes it can be difficult to blend those two worlds together or transfer the talents of one technique to the other. How do Daniel Craig and David Oyelowo handle this?
Well, the thing about, you know, what's great about British actors who are famous in movies when they do theater is that, with very few exceptions, like maybe Kate Winslet if she ever returned in a play, or Hugh Grant, who as far as I know has never done a professional play, but most British film actors began in the theater. So it's not like they're on stage going, oh wow, there are all these people there, what do I do? I have to speak up? Oh, I don't know how to do that. They know how to do it. It's where they started. So to answer your question, they acquit themselves really well. It's not by any means the Daniel Craig show, although he's wonderful in it. It's an ensemble piece that happens to have these two very fine actors at the heart of it. And actually, I think more than most Othellos I've seen, it's equally weighted. Usually the irony of Othello is that the play is dominated by Iago, who's the kind of malcontent of the piece. But in this one, David Oyelowo, who is, you know, classically trained, now he seems to be in every third film going, most recently United Kingdom and The Queen of Katwa and things like that. But he absolutely drives the piece as a sort of more M-O-O-R, who has a wife that he loves. And when that love for Desdemona is thwarted, questioned, whatever, chaos reigns. And Iago is the agent of the chaos.
Well, let's move on quickly now to another play that's happening at the moment. That's The Front Page. This one is, well, a lot of people would know this from the famous film version in 1940, His Girl Friday, which of course changed the gender of one of the lead characters and put it in a little bit of a love gone wrong situation, famously starring Cary Grant, Rosalind Russell. This one has Nathan Lane, John Slattery, and John Goodman. Now, I have to say I've not ever been lucky enough to see The Front Page on stage. I was just recently re-watching His Girl Friday in preparation for it to be featured on the cinema show this week. Yeah. Tell me about how this plays out on stage. I mean, Nathan Lane owns the stage, doesn't he?
Well, the thing about The Front Page on stage, Ben, and one of the reasons you probably haven't seen it, is that it's got a big cast. So there aren't a lot of theaters that are likely to do it just casually. But if you've got a starry production, which this one is, and you've got an uber-powerful producer, the almighty Scott Rudin, you have a chance of success. So even though this is not subsidized by the state or anything, it's a fully commercial production, it's already broken even, and it's going to make a nice profit by the end of the run, at the end of January. The great thing about this production is the level of anticipation, because it's a three-act play. You know, in the old days, this is a play from 1928, in the old days, plays were in many acts. Now they're kind of 70 minutes straight through. But Nathan Lane doesn't come in until well into the second act. So by the time he comes in playing the editor of the newspaper at the heart of the play, boy, is the audience revved up for his arrival, not least because you hear his voice in various communiques over a loudspeaker. So you get a taste of him without seeing him. And it's a fine production up to that point, but I wouldn't say it's anything special. But once Nathan Lane comes into it, the whole thing kind of lifts. He has this power to levitate the evening. For one thing, He has an amazing voice. He's got this sort of kind of bark that is seismic in its dimensions. And he just takes over the stage. It's really exciting to watch. And he's got such wonderful timing. He's a creature of the Broadway theater, of the likes that they really don't make anymore. You know, he does movies, he does TV, but he always comes back to the theater. The theater is his home.
He's indeed a man of the theater. Some are actually saying that this play really belongs to John Goodman, though. He's an awfully big talent as well. Tell us, what were your thoughts on him?
I wouldn't say that with all respect to him. Actually, I thought John Goodman on stage was better in London a season or two ago in a production on the West End here of American Buffalo, David Mamet's play that he did with Damian Lewis. I thought he really walked away with that production. In this one, for one thing, he's got a relatively small part. He plays the sheriff. I mean, he's okay, but he actually seems to be struggling to hold his own against the actual wattage that Lane projects. And there are a lot of other notable people in the cast. Robert Morse, who's now well into his 80s, who was a Tony winner back in, I think it was 1961 or 62, has a cameo in it. I mean, it's strongly cast across the board. The exciting thing, I think, for people in this country about the production is that if they were wondering when can they see Nathan Lane live in the UK, he is hopping the pond and will be on stage from April onward at the National Theatre, starring with Andrew Garfield in their production of Angels in America. So that should be really, really exciting at the National.
Certainly
Angels in America
to,
was done at the National originally and now coming back 25 years later.
And it'll be an absolute treat to see Andrew Garfield on that as well. Just quickly on the front page, though, because anyone who's seen the very famous film version, the film version is often credited with starting a lot of people's careers in journalism, creating this, well, if not creating, certainly cultivating to a large extent this romanticism for the age of the newspaper and that fast-paced world. It's the script is said to have been about double the size of most scripts because all the lines are delivered so quickly. But the character dynamics in the film version are really about this love story that happens between Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell. That, of course, is different in the original text. It's different in the play. It's different in the other film version, The Front Page. Give us a little bit of a taste for what are the character dynamics at play if that love angle is actually taken out?
Well, what happens really in the play version, of course, which is mostly male, there are a couple of women in it and they're very well played, but it's essentially a bromance between the editor, Nathan Lane's character, and his star writer, the John Slattery character. And in fact, what happens is that Nathan Lane rather dramatically pits John Slattery's love of journalism against his love of love, because he has a girl who he's going to marry and there's a mother-in-law who figures in the play. And he keeps saying, "Don't worry, darling, don't worry, I'll be with you, I'll be with you." But he can't resist the lure of the scoop, the lure of being on the front page. So no awards for guessing who wins. But Nathan Lane is a pretty potent adversary. The mother-in-law doesn't stand much of a chance.
Well, that is, we were first talking about Othello, which has just finished its run at the New York Theatre Workshop. And The Front Page is on at the Broadhurst Theatre until January the 29th. Well, let's bring things back to London now for a couple more plays on at the moment. We'll start at Wyndham's for The Kite Runner, which is the new production of the best-selling novel of the same name that follows an Afghan-American living in San Francisco who's haunted by his memories of Kabul in the 1970s. Matt, how has this been brought to life on the stage?
Not very well, I'm sorry to say, yeah. Ben. Not very well. It's interesting the way titles can acquire a life. So you have a best-selling novel, then a film was made of this, directed by Mark Forster, which I confess I've never seen, and then the stage version. And this is interesting also that the stage version has been kicking around for a long time. It began in Nottingham Playhouse about 3.5-4 years ago, finally come to London. It's not very good. You know, the first thing you're sort of told in introductory playwriting or introductory writing of any kind is show, don't tell. And these things are up for grabs. But the problem with this play is it is all narration. You know, a very good young actor, Ben Turner, comes to the front of the stage playing Amir, the central character, and he sort of relates the story. And then it's in flashback, so it's essentially a memory play about an event from his past in Afghanistan by which he is haunted for decades, even after he started a new life for himself in San Francisco. But he'll come to the front, big gobs of narration, then a tiny little bit that he talks about will be acted out, and then more gobs of narration. And after a while, you just think, well, why don't you just do this as a radio recitation? It's sort of defiantly undramatic, which is a shame. And then all of a sudden, at the very end, it gets really, really sentimental. Like, let's pull out all the tissue time. And I'm as weepy as the next person, but I'm afraid this left me cold.
So you would suggest then from that it might have more in common with an old radio play than what we're expecting to see on a stage.
Yeah, I think so. And it's also kind of awkwardly designed. Everything about it feels as if the stage isn't quite the right habitat for it. But at some point it was predetermined that it would be a play, so everyone has decided to forge on regardless. And I think one of the things about the theater, because it's live, is you have to trust your intuition. If it doesn't look right, don't do it.
I would have to suggest that maybe this is down to budget, or is it lack of imagination? Because just when you imagine the concept of these kite tournaments happening on a stage, it would be somewhat difficult to do that theatrically. However, it does lend itself quite well to having a bit of fun and being quite imaginative with how you would actually get that message across.
Yeah, it's not budgets that really are the issue. I mean, there are lots of small theatres in London, some of which we might talk about, that do very well on a tiny budget. I mean, the Royal Court upstairs, which we'll talk about, does amazing things. It's a failure of imagination. Sure, you don't get hundreds and hundreds of kites, and you don't get that kind of glorious aerial imagery that you might get in the film, which I didn't see. But there are other ways to bring that world to life on stage. This, everything here looks like half measures. And there's a kind of hilariously awkward moment where we arrive in San Francisco in the narrative, and all of a sudden they're singing, I think it's Locomotion, and they wear kind of groovy, trendy American clothing. And it's like, oh, so that's San Francisco because of the T-shirts and Locomotion? It all seems really ridiculously synoptic.
The Kylie Minogue version or the older version?
The older version, the period version, because I think it's 1981, something like that.
I see.
Pre-Kylie.
Important detail.
Pre-Kylie, Ben.
That's The Kite Runner on at Wyndham's Theatre until March the 11th. Now to the Southwark Playhouse for Promises, Promises. Now this is a play based on the 1960 Oscar-winning film The Apartment, which of course starred Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine. It first ran in London in 1969 and has been performed on Broadway over 1,000 times. Matt, I'm a huge fan of the original film. Of course, written and, co-written at least, and directed by Billy Wilder.
Yeah, famously.
Fantastic exploration of the dirty world of corporate politics. Tell us about this stage play, though. I wasn't actually aware of this stage play. I feel somewhat ignorant.
Yeah. They did a revival of it on Broadway in 2010, which I saw with Sean Hayes from Will and Grace and Kristen Chenoweth. And it was kind of awkward, but it had its moments. This one is more awkward than anything else and has fewer moments. The problem is the material is pretty intractable. The story now in 2017 seems kind of sleazy. I mean, what happens is this sort of lower employee in this company where he's trying to climb the ladder, played at Southwark Playhouse by the very charming Gabriel Vick, sort of ends up with this very nice apartment in the Upper West Side that now anyone would give their eye teeth for, but maybe things were different then because we're lent to believe it may not be so salubrious a part of New York. And so his apartment ends up being taken over at his behest, really, by all of his colleagues who are having affairs there at various times of the day or night. And our hapless hero, willingly colludes in this because he thinks that if he gives his partners a place to carry on their trysts, then he might advance up the corporate ladder because they were able to have their jollies. And you keep thinking, why don't you just go to a hotel? What were there no hotels in New York in the period in which this was written?
One would imagine that this is also set back in the 1960s.
Oh, it's absolutely. It's very, very much of its time.
Because in the film, we're led to believe, or we're led to assume, perhaps, that Jack Lemmon's character is going along with this ridiculous premise because he's quite afraid of his big bad boss, Fred McMurray. And his character comes across as the kind of man that you wouldn't want to cross anyway. Heaven forbid he should let him go and have to starve on the New York streets.
Well, there's a bad boss in this, Sheldrake, who's played by Paul Robinson, who's a musical theater veteran and a former Olivier Award nominee. And spoiler ahead, the crux of the plot is that the girl that our hero is dying to date and to have is discovered to be, at the end of the first act, the girl, the same girl with whom his bad boss is having this illicit liaison. Mm. So that's the dynamic on which the plot hangs. And her treatment, her name is Fran Kublik, the character's name, her treatment is very odd. She's, again, it's hard in 2017. She's such a doormat. I mean, she sings very well and is capable and articulate, but she seems to exist in a permanent state of despond. And it's not a surprise in the second act when there's an attempted suicide, and you just think, give the woman some credit for being able to speak for herself and function for herself. So I think it might be, you know, not every show in the world is at home in every period in the world. Mm. And this just might be one of these pieces that doesn't cross the decades.
Well, that's one of the reasons that we often don't like it when they start to remake classic films. Not yeah. only because a film is a classic for a reason, but also things don't necessarily translate into different eras, as you say. So, I mean, maybe one of the reasons we appreciate The Apartment, the film, so much is because we never got to see themes like mental illness and suicidal tendencies and a character like the one portrayed so perfectly by Shirley MacLaine. We never got to see those on the screen at all. So you look at that and it just feels like such a rare and precious gem of a film.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. That's entirely true. And of course, you can't praise Billy Wilder and his collaborator I.L. Diamond too highly, neither of whom are involved with the stage show at all. The stage show has a book by the venerable Neil Simon, who's now 89, 90, something like that, one of the last great American playwrights of the 20th century still living. But the thing about Neil Simon, which is always true, and it's a wonderful gift, is that he was a gagmeister. He had all the one-liners. They don't really sit very well with material that is this depressed. Not depressing, but depressed.
It does certainly go down in quite a trough, but at least judging from the film version, it certainly picks up. And there was actually a wonderful episode of Mad Men that was inspired by this film, in which the character Joan Holloway, the secretary, ends up accidentally taking on this role inspired by Shirley MacLaine's character. A wonderful piece of television. But the play we just spoke about is Promises, Promises. That's on at the Southwark Playhouse until February the 18th. Now, finally, we'll pay a quick visit to the Royal Court Theatre for Wishlist. This is an award-winning play by playwright Catherine Soper. Matt, what's it all about?
I love this. It was terrific. It's a new play, as you say, by a young writer. And it's, you know, it's in that best Royal Court tradition of reminding us of the lives that many people lead that we don't know about. And they are worthy of our attention, our consideration, and most of all, our compassion. It's about a young brother and sister whose mother has died, where that's not dwelled on. It's just a fact. And the brother has some sort of ill-defined obsessive-compulsive disorder, which means that he can barely leave his bathroom, let alone the flat. And so his sister, who's, you know, not even 20, is having to be mom and provider and everything. And she works in a packaging warehouse for a kind of Amazon-esque company, where she strikes up a rather sweet friendship with a younger guy who's a 16-year-old. And there's the glimmer of possible romance, but the fact is she keeps being pulled back to the reality of her domestic situation, which is a difficult one. But I think in some ways it's a love story, a platonic love story, between a brother and a sister who, despite everything, are living to see another day. And, you know, there are a lot of people for whom that isn't always true. Promises, Promises has a heroine who might not live to see another day. So what Wishlist really reminds you is that, you know, people do get by with fortitude on not very much. And it's a very fine production.
We were just talking about how Promises, Promises and The Apartment, it can be a little bit bleak and depressing in parts. It takes a very brave writer and a very talented cast and crew and talent behind the play to actually take you into very, very dark places and then somehow bring you back up again towards the end and leave you feeling like what you've seen was really worthwhile. Does this particular play, Wishlist, does that do that for you?
Yeah, in fact, and I won't give the specifics away of the terrible thing that happens near the end, but it's very dramatic and I don't quite know how the actor to whom it happens manages it, but this person manages it very well. However, the play does move on from that. And the suggestion is that there can be a second act in people's lives. You don't have to succumb to despair and despond in the first act. And it's really a remarkably moving and touching and fine-grained piece of debut writing, beautifully articulated by the cast and the director, and very much worth seeing.
Certainly finishing on a peak for this edition of the Monocle Arts Review then. The Wishlist is on at the Royal Court Theatre until the 11th of February. And that indeed is the end of today's programme. Thanks to our guest today, Matt Wolfe. This has been the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Ben Ryland. My producer was Holly Fisher, and the show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our book review. But for now, thanks for listening.